That's a give and take between Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt with The People's Choice. It's from their 1971 album, Ammons and Stitt, You Talk That Talk. And indeed, we're going to talk some talk today. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, January the 28th, 2015. And first, an explanation about yesterday's program is in order. You see, on Monday, when the blizzard of historic proportions was supposed to hit New York City and didn't, Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo decided on some emergency measures. The subways were shut down and a travel ban was imposed, so folks had to be off the street and off the roads by 11 o'clock. And were to be prepared to stay wherever they were, hopefully at home, the following day because, you know, well, it was the blizzard of historic proportions. Well, our engineers at PRN, when they heard that, had to scramble to put together shows for the next day. That's yesterday, because there was no telling whether they would be able to make it back to the studio to engineer live shows like Lead Stories. There was no telling whether they were even going to be able to make it home in time. So the rebroadcast of an old show was what you heard yesterday instead of the great and wonderful program that was scheduled about Obama's foreign policy with Gerald Horn. That will instead be heard tomorrow. So we have rescheduled that program. Well, I think it is very clear when the evidence is examined that Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo set out to intentionally sabotage this program. That's my claim. That's right. That's what they did. And they even arranged the fake-out so that the storm bypassed New York after all the drama and instead gave New England states a heck of a lot of grief. Well, all joking aside, though, I do want to talk today about the blizzard of historic proportions and other snow jobs. Let's take a look at what really happened here. We had the weather forecasters, mostly from, particularly I should say, from the National Weather Service, talking about the fact that a major blizzard, which de Blasio went on to describe as this, the blizzard of historic proportions. I think that phrase should just be saved somewhere, and every now and then we just need to call it up. The blizzard of historic proportions that was heading for New York City, that was expected to dump as much as 3 feet of snow and paralyze New York. And, well, yesterday we had the National Weather Service director basically going on the defensive, saying, well, you know, we thought we saw what we saw, and really there was a last minute change. The weather pattern changed in a last minute way, and instead the storm coursed its way up along the eastern seaboard to as far north as Maine. And it's not that we didn't really get it right. It's not that we were wrong about our forecasting. It's just that we should have done a better job of communicating that the projected pattern and the projected hit was kind of iffy. It was iffy all along. We knew it was iffy. We knew it was a kind of 50-50 proposition that the city might get hit and might not get hit. It was an iffy thing. But we didn't communicate that too well. We should have done a better job, says Mr. Uccinelli, Louis Uccinelli, who is the director of the National Weather Service. So he's being very defensive about the fact that people were bracing for the storm that did not happen. New York got a little dusting, but nothing unusual, really. But here's the thing. In the meantime, we had tremendous reaction on the part of the governmental structures here. Mayor de Blasio, it is now learned, was upstaged by Governor Cuomo. Because, you see, when you have weather patterns like this, when you have big storms, and all of this, by the way, may sound like something you won't want to happen. But in fact, to people like Cuomo and mayors of cities, large cities and so forth, this is a godsend. These things are fantastic. Why? Because they get to be literally commander-in-chief. They get to exercise power, unilateral power, and they get to demonstrate their will, and they get to demonstrate their skill at governance and all of that. But in any event, they have sole power at this point. A city is about to be blasted, major weather emergencies predicted, and so this is his shining hour. So what does the governor do? The governor says, well, look, I'm the big cheese here. I'm the big guy. I wield the power. And besides which, ultimately, I'm in charge. My power trumps the mayor's power. He's the number two man here. I'm number one. So tell you what we're going to do. We're going to shut down the subway system, the whole thing, not even parts of it. We're going to shut down the whole subway system. We're going to establish we're going to call a state of emergency. And we're going to do all this without necessarily calling the mayor. We don't have to talk to him. He's my subordinate, really. And I'm in charge of the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority. I don't have to consult with anybody. So I am going to declare the subways to be shut down. The whole system. Okay. So we're learning. There's a report filed by the bureau chief, the City Hall bureau chief for the Daily News, Jennifer Firmino. The headline says, De Blasio was in the dark about Cuomo order to close subway service. The subhead reads, the mayor was given 30 minutes notice before Governor Cuomo announced the subway system would be suspended at 11 p.m. on Monday night. This is not the first time Cuomo didn't break important news to City Hall. So you see, we have the subtext here is that, okay, the city is bracing, everybody is bracing for the snowstorm. Looking for leadership from the city's mayor, the chief executive, Bill de Blasio. And instead, we get the word from the governor because he is the big cheese. He is the big guy. And he is saying, well, you know, I'll give you 30 minutes notice as the mayor, the elected mayor of the city of New York. I'll give you about 30 minutes to tell your folks what I'm already announcing. That there's a state of emergency. I'm in charge. So they're settling political scores here. And when I say they, I really mean Cuomo. Cuomo is settling political scores. I'm going to preempt even you, Mr. Mayor. I am taking sole control of this whole thing. All right. So Governor Cuomo decides the whole system is going to be shut down. And he goes a step further. He declares a state of emergency. And in this state of emergency, we have some other things happening. There's a travel ban. A travel ban. Now, this travel ban comes with the threat of arrest and fines. If you are found on the road after 11, it was announced that you will face not only arrest, possible arrest, but a $300 fine. This is serious business. So all of this is happening, by the way, with differing opinions within the weather community, the weather forecasting community. The National Weather Service is saying one thing. They had predicted this huge storm, and on the basis of this prediction, we're getting all of these things happening on an emergency basis to safeguard the people of the city of New York. But at the same time, we have other meteorologists saying they didn't see that blizzard of historic proportions at all. Their calculation said that we're seeing something else. We get a little dusting, but New York City is really not on track for a blizzard of historic proportions. Of course, it's the only kind of blizzard one would have these days. So for the first time in 111 years, the entire subway system is shut down. Schools are closed. People are told to get out of Dodge, go home, get there by 11 o'clock, because after 11 o'clock, you know, it's martial law, and that's no fun at all. I just want you to appreciate here what really happened. We have what everybody should take seriously, which is supposedly an impending emergency situation, albeit, by the way, albeit predicated on false information. The National Weather Service was wrong. But the director, Kip, is given the opportunity now to say, well, we always knew it was iffy. It was iffy. But no other prevailing view as to whether there was going to be, in fact, a blizzard of historic proportions was allowed to come to play. It was the National Weather Service and their God, as far as weather is concerned, is only the National Weather Service. Nobody else can predict the weather. There's no other credible source. So the information is false or wrong or misleading. Whatever it is not exact and correct. And on the basis of this, the MTA's own people been following the weather patterns and following meteorological reports are saying to the mayor, we are getting entirely different readings here. Maybe we need to find out what exactly it is that we're facing. But no, the governor says, on the basis of the National Weather Service, Mr. Uccelli, these things are going to happen, and they're going to happen now. And it is such an emergency, I don't need to talk to the mayor of the city of New York. Meanwhile, millions of New Yorkers are scampering, trying to find their way home, trying to go get their kids from school, trying to pass by some kind of a grocery store or a supermarket to pick up something in the event of this blizzard of historic proportions. The first time the subway, the entire subway, was shut down in more than 111 years due to snow, supposedly. All of this is happening on the basis of flawed information. But this is not enough. What's happening here? Well, of course, the city got out of it, and it was clear after, you know, several hours. By midday yesterday, it was clear that the blizzard of historic proportions was, in fact, not going to hit. Definitive proof by midday yesterday. Okay. So we're all thankful, and Governor Cuomo says that that's the whole point. Better to be safe than sorry. Now, we're not discussing the cost. We're not discussing the panic that ensued in people. We're not discussing the inconvenience. We're not discussing a whole bunch of things. We're not discussing even the fact, according to some reports, that more than $200 million worth of business was lost because businesses had to shut down. We're not discussing these things. Yeah, I'm looking at the big picture here. All of this on flawed information and a clearly damaged ego and a kind of, I have to say, a power-hungry governor who thinks that this is the perfect time for him to flex his muscles, you see? He's got, in this regard, he is his father's son, Mario Cuomo. He is the father's son to a T. I'm in charge here. I'm running things. And because this gives him the opportunity to again stick his finger in de Blasio's nose, he does it. And this is reckless. This is a seriously reckless kind of leadership that says all of these things are happening based on my determination, my sole determination, and I'm okay with it. I'm okay with all the havoc being created, and not by the weather. This is havoc I am creating, and now the big task afterwards is to go on the PR offensive to say, now, isn't this the very picture of leadership? A responsible governor doing the right thing in the interest of the safety of the community and the people of the state of New York, and he is the head of the ship of state. He's at the helm. All right. Now, let's look at something else and why we should be very, very concerned here. We have, in effect, a renegade governor, a guy who believes he doesn't have to talk to anybody, he doesn't have to consult with anybody, he doesn't even have to respect the elected mayor of the city of New York. He doesn't have to give anything more than a 30-minute warning to the mayor that he has already amassed the media to announce these things that he is putting into effect. But what exactly was put into effect? These are the questions we need to ask. What kind of emergency did we have, actually? Did the governor ever say what kind of emergency it was? Was it a state of emergency? In which case, what was the legal justification for that state of emergency? And was it a snow emergency? Well, then, there are three levels of snow emergency. What exactly was the level? Did he explain to people, well, these are the things that are happening, and the law allows me to do A, B, C, and D in anticipation of the worst? Well, let me tell you, what we had, without anybody saying it, was we had martial law up until yesterday at midday, at least. That's what you had. Martial law was declared in New York City by the governor. Why? Because I just saw on the a news bulletin from the Department of Defense that talked about the National Guard being called out. 394 soldiers were on duty. This is filed on January the 27th. The New York National Guard had 394 soldiers on duty this morning as New York City, Long Island, and the lower Hudson Valley entered the second day of a three-day weather event. New York Governor Andrew M. Cuomo called out the National Guard troops as part of a coordinated New York State response. He declared a state of emergency yesterday and banned travel on major roadways last night. New York City and regional transit systems also were shut down. This is from the Department of Defense, and this is written by Eric Durr of the New York National Guard. So we had martial law declared, and we needed to know that. The people needed to know that. The city of New York was under martial law, disguised as a state of emergency, which, of course, was predicated on false information or flawed information. But at the same time, all of the residents and citizens of the city of New York were under martial law, complete with threats of fines and arrest for being on the street after 11 o'clock. When a hasty decision was made by this governor, without the consultation of the mayor of the city of New York, to shut down the entire subway system. The first time in more than 111 years, because he could do it. And it should not escape us that it was, in fact, a wonderful demonstration from Cuomo's point of view as to how to contain an entire city. That's what the city of New York was able to demonstrate. That under the guise of this emergency situation, the weather, something we can't control, and again, flawed information, they could shut down the entire city. Wherever you are, you're going to stay there. We have you contained. We have you under heavy manners. And this should cause some concern. Big time concern. Because at the very least, people are entitled to know what exactly is the state of their existence at any particular time, including when they are supposed to be bracing for a blizzard of historic proportions. Your rights don't disappear. Imagine if people were trying to just get home because the subway is shut down, what if somebody wanted to get grandma off the street by any means necessary and risk arrest and a fine for just trying to go get grandma? What are you just walking down the street and you presume you had the right to walk down the street? Let's say you didn't hear about this martial law. You're just walking down the street, happy that the blizzard of historic proportions was not affecting you. And next thing you know, you have to go hire a lawyer. Next thing you know, you're riding in the back of a patrol car, headed on your way to the local precinct to be booked for walking down the street. When the governor has decided there's martial law. Now, I don't mean to make a huge issue of all of this, but it is a huge issue, you see. Because we have a dictatorial governor deciding he doesn't have to account to anybody. He's operating under the aegis of the powers that are granted to him constitutionally, even if that means that your constitutional rights are going to be suspended. No explanations are due to the people to say, well, folks, this is what the situation is. This is what we have to do. And I have spoken to the mayor, and ideally there should have been a joint news conference, because since this was supposed to be so serious, it warranted that kind of response. But we have a governor with a huge and damaged ego who cannot miss the opportunity to show off his proescient leadership. And so he arrogates to himself all of the powers. Well, then you should therefore deal with, arrogate to yourself all of the responsibility. And people should demand some explanations. And there ought to be an official inquiry into this, because the flip side of this coin is, yes, everything went well and we didn't have any major weather-related disasters and so forth, but we have some serious constitutional questions here. And we have a very good argument, a very strong argument, that the governor himself and de Blasio, by not fighting the governor, that this literally, the actions taken were in fact potentially life-threatening to the people of the city of New York. When you can't get home because somebody decided at 4 o'clock that this is going to be the case, and the subways are going to shut down by 11 o'clock, and you're working a shift, and you can't get home, and you have to stay in place and whatnot, and the information from the very beginning is flawed. But you don't care about double-checking. You don't care about a second opinion. You have the wherewithal to use the taxpayer-subsidized services and agencies to your whim. And you can gain great political points with that, especially now that his administration is undergoing one of the most comprehensive reviews for corruption. So he needs all of the political points that he can get. And he was willing and clearly able to use the auspices of his office to score points. That's one level. I again remind you that the major implication here for us, the people, is that we saw a demonstration of the awesome power of the state, the awesome and unilateral power of the state. And it can continue, it can impose its will, it can cause even great hardship, and it can operate even outside of the Constitution in cases of emergencies like the blizzard of historic proportions. I'll come back after this little break and talk about another snow job. We'll be right back. listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, I want to talk about two stories that came out of Israel that dispel the notion that there is this monolithic view that Benjamin Netanyahu is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and the nation is solidly behind him. Quite the opposite. I read the papers of Israel quite regularly, and it is an amazing thing that the information you get is so different from the information that you would readily have access to via the New York Times or the Washington Post or some of the other major papers. It's like two different worlds entirely. In Israel, I've said it before, there is resistance to Netanyahu's regime. And it has been consistent. It doesn't get very much coverage. But there is no monolithic support for Netanyahu. This story was filed by Reuters. And it concerns, well, let me read you the headline. It says, Israeli intel unit drops soldiers who refused to spy on Palestinians. This was filed 2 days ago. Israel's top military electronic surveillance unit expelled dozens of veterans on Monday for refusing to spy on Palestinians living under occupation, Army radio said. The commander of Unit 8200, named as Brigadier General A, barred the 43 reserve officers who wrote to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and top army chiefs in September, saying they could no longer serve in the unit, the radio said. Coming a few weeks after Israel's 50-day war against Islamist militants in the Gaza Strip, the letter was seen as an unprecedented rebuke of Netanyahu's security policies, but the military dismissed it as a publicity stunt by a small fringe. By decrying the sweep of eavesdropping on Palestinians and the role such espionage plays in setting up airstrikes that have often inflicted civilian casualties, the move opened a window on clandestine practices. Quote, "We refuse to take part in actions against Palestinians and refuse to continue serving as a tool for deepening military rule in the occupied Palestinian territories," the Yediot Aharonot daily quoted the letter as saying. No signatories' names were published, in apparent keeping with their non-disclosure commitments to Unit 8200, which monitors enemy Arab states and Iran, as well as the Palestinians. Several were interviewed anonymously in the Israeli media, however, and complained about what they described as gathering of Palestinians' private information, for example, sexual preferences or health problems that might be used to extort people into becoming informants. Channel 1 TV quoted from Unit 8200 Commander's dismissal letter, quote, "You have crossed a red line and acted inappropriately, and in light of that, you have, in light of what you have written, we part company with you," unquote. Now, what does that letter say? What does that story say? It says that there is a surveillance, constant surveillance of Palestinians, and we have military personnel openly refusing to participate in this function. We don't hear about these things. We don't hear about this at all. And they're saying that the information that they are assigned to gather is of a nature that would be used to extort people into becoming informants. What more needs to be said? But you have here a story of a military unit, an intelligence gathering military unit, that is opposing, openly opposing their commander in chief, in effect, saying, we're not part of this dirty war. We're not going to do it. The other piece I want to share with you is written by Don Futterman. This was printed in Haaretz, the oldest paper in daily newspaper in Israel. It is akin to the New York Times of Israel in terms of its leverage and its importance in Israel. And Don Futterman is writing here in connection with the pending visit of Netanyahu to a joint session of Congress to address the joint session of Congress on the matter of Iran. He is the program director of Israel for the Moriah Fund, a private American foundation working to strengthen society and promote democracy and peace in Israel. This is his description, writing this opinion piece. Well, what does Don Futterman say? The title is U.S. Jews Choose Obama Over Bibi. Bibi is the name by which Netanyahu popularly is known. Is Congress truly dependent upon the wisdom of Israel's premier to decide what to do about Iran? And does antagonizing the very world leaders Israel is most dependent upon to stop Iran serve Israel's interests or Bibi's electoral ambitions? Futterman writes, Jewish American leaders must choose U.S. President Barack Obama over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It is time for them, together with Jewish leaders around the world, to acknowledge what much of the Israeli electorate already knows. Netanyahu is bad for the Jews. American Jews have always been careful to show respect to the office of the President of the United States, even when they were less than enamored with the Middle East policies of the person holding it. They must now find the courage to acknowledge that an Israeli prime minister who insults both the office and the president is no friend of American Jewry. Netanyahu's vendetta against Obama is particularly galling because Israelis and Jewish Americans have rarely had a friend in the White House as committed, generous, and reliable in his support for them as the current president. Jewish American leaders should find themselves in an uncomfortable position when Netanyahu addresses Congress against the wishes of the president. An Israeli politician who makes common cause with one American political party over the other damages bipartisan support for Israel, regardless of whether politicians from both sides of the aisle give Netanyahu ovations, as they have in the past. An Israeli leader who works actively with the Republican Party to discredit the Democratic Party is spitting in the face of the American Jewish electorate, which has given 64 to 90% of its vote to the Democratic presidential nominee in almost every election for the past 50 years. I do not envy Jewish American leaders who have to distinguish between the office of the prime minister as the leader of the state of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu, a jingoist politician who always puts his personal political ambitions first. Netanyahu knows that appearing to stand up to foreign leaders plays well to his voter base, who revel in the illusion that their strong leader won't let anyone tell Israel what to do, and that for after 6 years of Likud-sponsored attacks on Obama, many of Netanyahu's followers mistakenly believe that Obama is not a friend of Israel. Rather than welcoming Israel's prime minister with the usual fanfare and adulation, Jewish American leaders should signal him that his grandstanding is not appreciated when it gratuitously thrusts American Jews and Israel between two branches of U.S. government. Ostensibly, Netanyahu will speak to Congress to express Israel's desperate need to stop Iran's nuclear program. Like most Israelis, I believe that Iran poses an existential threat to our future. Jews everywhere are right to feel endangered by Iran. The apparent assassination last week of prosecutor Alberto Nisman in Argentina, just before he was to present evidence of a cover-up of Iran's involvement in the 1994 bombing of the Buenos Aires Jewish Community Center, brings home the immediacy of the menace and the long arm of our opponent. But I do not think that the U.S. Congress needs Benjamin Netanyahu to explain again his well-publicized opposition to the current negotiations or the dangers posed to the Western world by Iran's subversive global activities. Over the last several years, Netanyahu has sounded the alarm about the Iranian threat repeatedly and with consistent urgency, if with intermittent timing. The result has been for Netanyahu to turn himself into the boy who cried wolf. Unlike the situation in the United States, only some European leaders acknowledge the danger, but too many cannot abide the messenger. The Charlie Hebdo and kosher supermarket massacres brought home this risk more than ever. Europeans have long stopped listening to Israel's prime minister. This state of affairs is tragic, and it is Netanyahu's fault. A responsible leader would have worked overtime to strengthen the alliance with Israel's most important allies, the U.S. president and the heads of Europe, for a united campaign against Iran's nuclear ambitions. Instead, Netanyahu has made a practice of insulting our most important partners, most recently when he antagonized the president of France and other European leaders by his self-aggrandizing behavior at the Solidarity March in Paris. And the Paris incident, of course, was minor compared to the enmity toward Israel that Netanyahu's consecutive governments have cultivated among European leaders by expropriating Palestinian land and expanding settlements. Netanyahu acts as if the Israeli right need never compromise to assuage our allies. The world will recognize the justice of their cause, and if it doesn't, its criticism can be exploited for political gain. This is a terrible miscalculation. More than three-quarters of Israeli voters rejected Netanyahu's party in the 2013 elections, and current polls forecast similar results in 2015. While Netanyahu was able to form the government due to Israel's factional parliamentary system, the vote hardly represented an overwhelming mandate for a man who fancies himself the leader of the Jewish people. I cannot resist pointing out that more Jews voted for Obama than Netanyahu. It is time for American Jewish leaders to pluck up the courage to say no to an Israeli prime minister who uses a feud between the Democratic president and the Republican-dominated Congress for a stunt to boost his television ratings back home. It is time for Jewish American leaders to say no to Benjamin Netanyahu. That was written by Don Futterman, and it was printed in Haaretz, the major news daily in Israel. It ran on the 25th of January. Yet another indication, and this is, I mean, it's, there's a lot of this. This is just typical. This is not a, you know, a single example. There is a lot of disagreement and a lot of discussion, dissident discussion in Israel, but we don't hear about it. You'd never know that there are people who are extremely dissatisfied with Netanyahu's government, with his way of acting, and with this notion of, I mean, the heavy-handed brand of Zionism that says, at all costs, we must prevail. At all costs. And everything, therefore, in pursuit of the Zionist objective is allowable. There's nothing to be criticized if, in fact, it is about establishing, as he regularly calls it, the Jewish state. So why do we have, these are just two examples, in our own backyard, we have the media playing in mostly a compliant role in not asking the hard questions. It may seem like a simple thing, you know, it may seem almost unimportant and irrelevant, really, that we're talking today about a snowstorm that didn't happen, but it is not about that, is it? It is about the abuse of power. It is about the will of people who are elected, the will to dominate and to usurp power. And even if it costs millions of others great inconvenience and even a threat to their constitutional rights, it's okay because I have the power to do this. I can do this. And I need to do this for my own personal political ambitions. That's really what the story is here. And now is a great effort to persuade us that it's really about us being grateful that the insightful leadership of this despot, of a governor, is what has saved the people of the city of New York from grievous harm. It's a snow job. And we got a glimpse from these two articles that I read that the opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel by Israelis, that it doesn't even exist. When he comes here at the invitation of John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, to address a joint session of Congress, he is arriving as a man with solid backing, monolithic backing from the people of Israel. And he speaks for all. But Futterman says, who is this guy who keeps touting himself as the leader of the Jews? There clearly is great disagreement about that. And why don't we know these things? Of complicity. People make the decisions, and the gatekeepers of news, the people who are in charge of what we see and hear and read in the way of information, they are the ones who tell us what's important and what's not. They're the ones who shape the story. They're the ones who tell us what the priorities are, what to think. And when there's a vested interest in shaping what we think, they, of course, go into their typical mode of doing a snow job. So these two stories, these two subjects today, give us the opportunity to discuss snow jobs. I hope you found them useful. Tomorrow, of course, we will return with the program that originally had been scheduled on the day of the historic blizzard of historic proportions. Gerald Horn will be with us. We'll be talking about President Obama's recent forays into India and Saudi Arabia and other related events on the global or panoramic view of the president's foreign policy objectives in his penultimate year. Man on fire. The man is all over the place, sealing deals and getting ready for Hillary. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Until then, thank you so much for being with me today. I do want to encourage you always to send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. That's on email. And Lead Stories with Utrice Lead on Facebook. I always enjoy hearing from you, and I try my best to answer as quickly as possible, to respond to you as quickly as possible. Thank you so much for the pleasure and the great privilege of your company. We'll see you tomorrow, having survived the blizzard of historic proportions.